dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers. To the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. Your CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source code, ISOs, RAM, SIP, SIPs. Dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
That's right, I'm back on Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 148. I am Stank Dog. Today is May 16th, 2006. And I am here wrapping up Season 3 of Binary Revolution Radio, coming back to take over for a few episodes and see if I can still pull this off. So far, I don't know how it's going, but we'll see if we can pick it up with this episode with a returning friend of the show, someone who always, gosh, we go into an hour conversation before the show and I always learn something from, and that is, of course, Decius, our good friend from over at memestreams.net, is back on the show with us. Welcome, my friend.
How's it going?
Going pretty good. Going pretty good. I guess we'll find out at the end of the episode here, because this is going to be the thing about the main topic today, and the main topic we're going to do is rainbow tables, is a very mathematically challenging. Is that a good way to put it?
I think that there's a lot of people in the scene who, you know, they think it's cool to have these tools and try to, you know, they think it's fun to break into stuff. And, you know, I think that really what it's about is understanding why things work, as opposed to, you know, simply being able to do them or to run some program. And so I think that, you know, this is a challenging topic perhaps, but it's interesting at the same time. And the whole point of this stuff is to really delve into sort of deep technical subjects and kind of really understand them. So, I think it's good.
And we're going to do that. We're going to actually get into a little bit of the math on here. And by the way, that description you just gave, that's what separates a hacker from a script kiddie. Is
absolutely
using a tool and knowing how a tool works and knowing what a tool is doing. But I digress on that subject. We are actually going to touch on the math a little bit, because I got a little bit of it from reading a lot of these papers. This is pretty complex stuff, and that's why I thought you'd be the perfect person to come on the show and help us out with this. So that's going to be our main topic later on. Oh, and I should also thank you up front. Anybody who's ordered magazines lately has noticed that they got some extra stickers in there. They got the Industrial Mimetics stickers donated by memestreams.net. If you're not already checking out that site, you are missing out. So go check that out. And if you're ordering magazines, or if you bump into me at a VinRev meeting or something along those lines, we've been handing those out there as well. So decorate your laptops up with some stickers, and you'll be cool. It's that easy. I mean, people don't realize it's just that easy to be cool. Put an industrial mimetic sticker on your laptop, instant coolness.
All the girls will want to talk to you.
And people are busy shopping at Hot Topic. Is that the name of the place, Hot Topic?
Man, it's not punk if there's a franchise fee.
Exactly. All right.
It's like getting a dead Kennedy's toy with your Happy Meal.
you get a temporary tattoo sick kit. Anyway, on that note, I guess we will go into some email. And our first email this week comes from Eggman. Eggman says, "Hey, Black." Of course, he's referring to Black Ratchet, who has been hosting the show for Season 3. Shouts out to him again for doing a great job. Heard you and Stank talking about having Prawn on the bus via EVDO and thought you might get a kick out of this. And he sends a link. I will put this in the show notes. I did not tiny URL it because, yeah, it's been a while and I guess I suck at this job now. In the old days, I would tiny URL that out. But anyway, basically the Hawaiian bus system has started testing the usage of Wi-Fi on the bus as a public service. Nice service, powered by Sprint, so I assume it runs over EVDO. I did a speed test and got around 300 kbps. Anyway, nice show, and ask Stank not to yell like that. I do have neighbors. Well, fuck your couch, first of all. Fuck your neighbors. EVDO, 300 kbps, that sounds accurate. That is the kind of download speed you're going to get. I'm interested to know how this works as far as how they're aiming this at the bus. How is this staying stuck to the bus? What's to stop somebody from, I mean, if you're at the bus stop, can you get these signals? Or even just on this, I mean, how are they targeting these kind of things? They put antennas in the bus? I really don't know enough about this, but I find it interesting.
I think that might be the case. I know that a couple of the Silicon Valley companies, they run buses up to San Francisco to pick people up to go to work because traffic is terrible there. And they'll have, you know, a cellular connection in the bus, and they'll have a Wi-Fi, you know, card in, you know, in the bus. And so people in the bus can connect to the wireless card in the bus and use the Internet via the cellular link.
Oh, well, what's in it for the cell phone companies? Why is the cell phone company doing this?
The cell phone companies don't like it at all.
Oh, wow.
they were initially pretty unhappy about it, but perhaps in this case they've finally gotten the clue and decided that, you know, if they don't deploy this sort of service, that someone else will. So,
well,
I'm sure they're getting. In this case, these are municipal buses. I'm sure that the city is paying for them. So
they're certainly getting money from somebody. They're not going to do it, you know, for free. They're not going to donate it. But is there enough infrastructure in place with the cell phone towers to do this, though? I mean, like, I guess on city buses, you're talking about a fairly small population of people still, quite honestly. There's not many people on a bus at any given time, and maybe one of them, if any, is using it, one or two of them. Using it, so it's probably not a huge traffic load compared to their regular customers that have EVDO cell phones. But at some point, I mean, is EVDO an option? And they're totally going kind of way away from this email. Is EVDO, you think, a good option to cover, like, a city to offer free? Because I know Philadelphia, I think, was one I read about, several communities that are trying to cover the city with free access to the Internet. Most of them I read about are Wi-Fi. Do you think EVDO or something along those lines might be better, or?
Well, I mean, I think that Wi-Fi is the best option right now as a sort of the way to connect to the directly to people's laptops. But you don't backhaul it with Wi-Fi. I mean, you can, but it's a lot of work. excuse me. You can do sort of directional antenna and backhaul it with Wi-Fi, but it makes more sense to backhaul it with something else. I worked on a really interesting project a few years ago where we were looking at doing dense urban areas where we did 802.11b as the connection to people's laptops, and we had these devices on the roofs of buildings in the city, and the devices themselves interconnected in a mesh using 802.11a. Now you've got G, which gives you the speed of A on the frequency range of B, and so things have changed a little bit. But when we were working on this project, you know, B is like 11 megabits per second, and A is something like between 20 and 40 megabits per second, depending upon how you have it configured. So, you could backhaul, you could build this sort of backbone between all these little 802.11 B access points using 802.11a links that had more bandwidth. And so I think that that's what makes sense. You want to, maybe it's not 802.11a, maybe it's, EVDO or Edge or something else that you're using in the back end that's providing service through a little box that essentially acts as a wireless access point and has an 802.11b card in it.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess that's true. You could chain the technologies together in an interesting way, I guess. When I went up to Atlanta for InterZone a couple months ago, there was TV. Somehow TV was being streamed to the, I guess, trains or subway car. I don't know what you refer to them there, the MARTA cars. There was actually a TV signal being fed to those, and I found that interesting of how that was being done, and I didn't even think about checking for a wireless signal in there.
I don't think they have them. I don't know how they're pumping the TV to the trains either. I'm not sure what they did there.
Yeah, that could be interesting there. I noticed it, of course, when I first got on there. I found it interesting, and especially when we were going through tunnels, and the signal didn't disappear completely when we went underground or went under a building or anything like that. So,
was it real-time TV? Were you getting the news?
Yeah, I think it was. I don't remember what channel. It was fixed on some news channel, though. I don't remember if it was local or if it was a CNN. Yeah, I don't remember too much, honestly. But
yeah, I'm not sure. There's a couple companies that have popped up that are, you know, sort of, they've got technology that's specifically designed for trains to offer that kind of stuff. But I'm not exactly sure what they do.
Well, and I find all of those interesting. Even you know, a few of the plane airline companies are putting that on their planes. I know Song, when I had my Song flight to Vegas last year for DEF CON, that they had the TVs in the back of the plane, and it was, I think it was powered by, I want to say Dish Network or one of the, maybe it was DirecTV, I don't remember. But, you know, I find that very interesting. I mean, obviously they track the planes in the air, so they know where they're at, but it still seems like a stretch to beam the signal to a terrestrial tower and then back up to a plane.
Was yet, the TV really real time?
It was, well, I'm sure there was some kind of lag or delay, but I can't really compare it to anything, obviously. But no, it was like, you know, I was watching news that was from that day or from that hour. I mean, it was recent, up-to-date stuff. It was not recorded. And I
changed
channels.
One thing they might be doing is they might be hauling, you know, they'll transmit, you know, a couple copies of a program, you know, and then people can pull it off of, you know, tape in the plane, and while it's playing, it'll transmit another program, something like that.
Hmm.
You know, so they get a little staggered. They can show you a news program that's really fresh if you're on a long flight, but you know, it's not. But you're not watching it live necessarily.
Yeah,
it's getting fed up there and then played.
Yeah, it was pseudo live. I'm sure it was some kind of delay in there. But you know, like when 8 o'clock came around, the 8 o'clock shows came on, or you know, the 11. Like for example, I think Leno or something came on at 11 or 11:30 or whenever that damn show was supposed to come on. So it was giving the fairly live. I don't know exactly how it was getting handed off, but it was interesting anyway. When I see that kind of stuff, it's just the geek in me, I guess. I want to know how that sort of stuff works. It just pops into my head. So if anybody knows, by all means, email us radio@benrev.com and fill in some of the blanks for me there, guys.
One time I flew EVA Air, which is a Taiwanese airline, and they had a camera underneath the landing, like underneath the plane, and you could sort of see the front landing gear.
No.
And it was one of the channels on the TV in your chair.
Oh,
and so,
awesome.
You know, at any point where you're flying along, you could switch to this channel and see and look down on Earth. And as you were landing, it was a pretty wild experience to watch the landing through that camera,
yeah,
as if you were
awesome.
Sort of strapped to the bottom of the plane.
Yeah, that's cool. And I, you know what, now that you mention that, there was one channel on there that was basically GPS. It would tell you exactly where we were. It showed the map of the states, and it showed a little plane icon to show exactly how far we are, and an estimate of how much time it was left to go, how many miles were left to go, and our coordinates and stuff like that. So there was some kind of GPS obviously going on there. All right, anyway, let's move on to email number two from... Well, we're going to call them ESD, because we don't read real names on here. ESD says, "Good afternoon. I was just writing to say that I'm a loyal listener to the show. I am not sure where to ask this question, so I am coming to you guys with it." Now, the email this week, let me break off for a second. The email this week is very all over the place, so I don't really have specific answers for this, quite honestly. So that's why we're both kind of just brainstorming here and thinking this through. My question is, is it possible to make your laptop self-destruct? Say if the feds were at your door and you were in danger of having your laptop snatched for evidence or something, Is there a preferably free or low-cost software package, say, that would, upon a predefined keystroke, wipe all data from the hard disk? I guess I am asking if, first, has it been done, and second, if so, how was it done? Because heaven forbid if someone snatched my computer, there is some info that I would not want a person getting their hands on. Thanks. And this question actually is surprisingly common. I mean, I think hackers in by general nature are uber paranoid people. So it is an interesting question. And I guess, didn't Kevin Rose answer this with the thermite and Ramsey and the broken or something like that?
Yeah, I think there was a talk at Outer Zone about using thermite to destroy a hard drive. It was like a USB hard drive, and if you plugged it into a computer that wasn't running the right kind of driver, it would ignite this thermite and it would eat the drive.
Oh.
Kind of overkill, perhaps.
Yeah, wouldn't that eat more than the drive?
Entertaining presentation.
Yeah, that would eat more than the drive. That would eat through the drive, and then whatever the drive was sitting on, and then burn down the house that the drive was in.
It would go through the floor and just keep going.
So let's say, joking aside now, I guess it's probably dangerous to even have this around, but isn't probably the most reliable way to take a very strong magnet and put up against your drives and just, because disk drives are still magnetic storage.
You can buy a degaussing machine. They sell industrial degaussers. People have reasonable IT departments that, care about information security usually have degaussers, so that they can wipe, drives, from former employees or things that they're, you know, like if you're taking computers off the line and you're putting them into, you're sending them to a recycling center or you're going to resell them, you want to wipe your data off of them. And so they'll have these things, the big magnets, and you flip a switch and it just wipes the disk right out.
And the problem of having one of those nearby is, as a train is going by behind you, it sounds like, is...
Sorry, there's a plane flying overhead.
is if you accidentally flip that switch and, you know, wipe out your data when you didn't want to. You've got that innate danger. So if you're that uber paranoid to keep that around,
be too paranoid to have the degausser.
Yeah.
If one of your buddies comes over some night and thinks it's weird and presses the button, that'll be it for your computer.
Yeah, what's this do?
Yeah, you could also make your own electromagnetic pulse device.
You wipe out a lot more than the computer.
There are straightforward things that you could do in terms of, you know, like PGP has, a file shredder, software that's really user friendly, and there are, sort of raw write, I think is a utility for Linux, that does some pretty, sort of complete deletion and wiping of files, if you got a utility like that and set up a script somewhere where you can, you know, just click on something and it deletes stuff.
There are several open source drive disk wiping utilities that'll use the different. As a matter of fact, Diffie-Hellman standard for how many times you wipe over a drive, wasn't that something they also had their name attached to? 27.
I don't know if they had a standard for that, but there is a federal government standard for that.
Yeah, there's several DODs.
You know, the tool that I'm thinking of is not raw write, but it starts with R, and I don't remember what it's called.
There's one called R-Wipe, R-W-I-P-E.
Yeah, it's R-Wipe maybe is what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, that might be one. There really are several of them. If you go hit up SourceForge and look for drive wiping or what. I actually have two of them on one of my machines that I like to keep the free disk space, anything that's been written to, cache, file, stuff like that. I have it wipe my free space once every week, overnight, kind of like a virus scanner. You schedule it to run late night on the weekends or something, or one day when you're not going to be using it. And I can't remember. I know R-Wipe was one of them, and I can't remember what the other one was called, but like I said, there are several, and I just have it set up to wipe my free space. So basically, that'll wipe out any of my temporary files. It'll empty my temp directory, empty my cache from my browser and stuff like that. It will delete any space that I've freed up recently. So if I have, I don't know, I'm not going to go listing any files, but if I had something on there questionable and moved it to a CD or something, this will go behind it and wipe the remnants of it. And I usually set it to run once every week with a 7-pass DOD standard, which is a low one of their lowest standards. And then I think there's a 21 pass, I want to say, that will really wipe it so that it's almost unrecoverable. The 7's pretty darn good, too. They'd really have to work to recover that. But the 21 is like for top secret drives, the DoD standard, if they really want to wipe something of their own. And you know what? If they're happy with 21 wipes, I'm pretty happy with 21 wipes. So, I'm not sure if that exactly answers your question. I mean, to me, there's not like a... If you're asking for like an easy solution, as usual in hacking, there is no magic button or no easy way to set this up. Especially if they bust down the door and you're caught with your dick in your hand, you're screwed. There's nothing you can do that quick that you're going to be able to wipe it unless you got that decalcer switch right there in arm's length, you know, and... Yeah.
It's more like if they showed up at your house because you did something, they probably know what you did. And if you wipe your computer because you press a button and they figured out that's what you did, they'll probably charge you with destroying evidence or something to that effect as well. So.
Of course, depending on what you did, that might be a lesser charge than.
Yeah, it might be, but
we won't go there.
I might suggest maybe the button you want is your lawyer's speed dial number.
Yeah. We're not going to endorse that, but anyway. No, unfortunately, I can't think of those are some utilities, hopefully, that are helpful in physical destruction of drives and stuff. I mean, how about, there's so many different types of forensics that they can do on drives now. There's drive shaving, there's so much stuff. I mean, what about... I mean, now we're getting, like, old school here. What if you just took the drive? Obviously, you couldn't do this, like, in an emergency situation he's describing. But let's say you had a drive with, I don't know, you had virus code or pirated MP3s and your MPAA, you're worried about them or whatever. How about taking it out and, say, catching it on fire? Do you have any idea if that would be... Or chopping it with an axe or just crushing it? I mean...
There are data recovery services that attempt to help people whose drives have been physically damaged. I think you're much better off with a software solution or some sort of magnetic solution as opposed to attempting to burn it, or cut it up because those things are easier to recover. It's a pain in the neck, but there are people who do that for a living.
So. Software sounds like the way to go, and it's probably easier in the grand scheme of things anyway. All right, our last email this week comes from the Apple Man. Apple Man says, listening to 146 a few weeks late, but I'm sending you this email from my MDA, the one with the slide-out keyboard. From my experience, it really sucks. You can't talk on Skype, the battery lasts a day max, and the touchscreen gets way too dirty. It's so bad, I already have to send it back to be repaired twice in 6 months. It crashes all the time and needs to be reset whenever you want to use it. Knot Theory suggested the MDA Pro, which is the one with the spin-around screen, which, although big, is more powerful, has video calling and a huge battery, and, well, if you get stuck outside of your house, ... Okay, you left me hanging on that one, but, I'm not sure what he was getting at with the outside of your house. The MDA Pro has built-in Wi-Fi, but it also has built-in Bluetooth, and I'm pretty sure it had EDVO, high-speed, third-generation, high-speed cell network support, so if you get stuck outside your house, you're still going to have access. I'm not sure what he's getting at there. Can I ask you what kind of phone you have, Decius?
I have a Sidekick, which I'm really happy with. The thing that kind of sucks about it is that it doesn't. You can only write Java software for it, and the Java software doesn't give you sort of rich access to the hardware. So it's not like a great phone for hacking, but it's a really usable phone. The keyboard's really big. It's great for instant messaging. The software is well designed, and there's nice things about it. The calculator application that it comes with actually says 31337. on the icon for the calculator, which I thought was a nice touch.
Right.
There's an SSH client for it. You can sit on IRC. I think they're coming out with a Sidekick 2 soon, so if you're thinking of investing in one of these things, you might want to wait, because the Sidekick 2 will have faster internet access. Sidekick 3 is
right.
what I'm thinking of.
Right.
I have a Sidekick 2. I'm pretty happy with it. I've got a number of friends who have sort of Windows mobile devices, which are really expensive, but they're very nice and they're very programmable. So if you want to write interesting sort of cell phone software, that's probably a better environment for getting low level access to the hardware.
Yeah, I have the Trio 700, which I talked about on the show last week, the 700W, which is the Windows-based, and when it actually is not crashing, it actually is not so... that's a lie. It sucks pretty hard. So tell me about your Sidekick. Do you bust out the Bedazzler and put little shiny jewels in, like, My Pretty Pony pictures?
Perhaps cheeky. Paris Hilton has one of these things, but it's fine. It's very functional. It works really well for what I need it for, which is to SMS and send instant messages. And I'm not such a fan of the ringtones and the different colored LEDs and things like that, but I had a friend who had a Trio for a while, and he got it, and he didn't like the Sidekick in the beginning because he was like, dude, I can't write good software for that. I want to play with my phone.
Right.
And just over time of seeing mine and like playing with it, he decided it was better, particularly because the keyboard's really big.
Yeah, as far as using functionality out of the box, I do think the Sidekick is been the best one to do that, development for it's kind of rough. Getting anything published and made available for it's kind of rough. Actually, this MDA Pro the Apple man here mentioned, the MDA Pro is just an incredibly cool looking phone. It's kind of like what is that new Microsoft Origami, I think they call it. It's not quite that, but it is kind of the biggest, I guess, PDA phone, most powerful PDA phone, because it has the built-in Wi-Fi. It has all the stuff that almost you'd expect with a laptop. So it's really cool that you can pretty much, if you're in the house, use your Wi-Fi. If you're out of the house, use the EVDO network or whatever high-speed network it supports. The problem is this thing is probably still 2 years away from a U.S. release. I was waiting on this phone. There were rumors that this phone was going to come out with T-Mobile or for T-Mobile, and my contract was up on my last phone, which was just a Motorola, gosh, I don't remember. It was a very watered-down CMS phone, contact management phone, with a little bit of contact application. That's it. So I waited for this to come out, and when they finally announced their MDA, it was actually what they announced it as plain as just an MDA, which is equivalent, I think, to an MDA 3 in other countries, the third in the series. The MDA Pro is, I think, around the fifth generation. So the stuff that we're releasing here is a couple generations behind. So once they announced that the MDA was the one they released and it was not the MDA Pro after all, I broke down and got the Trio 700. And again, I'm not happy with it, but it's the best solution for what I wanted, to be able to get my email on the go, and I didn't want to get tied down to a CrackBerry because I wanted the other functionality that goes along with the Windows operating system, and that is, and it's silly stuff. I'm not really into the ringtones too much either, but I like to be able to have Hack TV in my phone and maybe whip it out and show it off sometimes, play a little Hack TV for somebody, or any video for that matter, but play MP3s, stuff like that on it. It's kind of a cool feature to have. And other silly things like games or whatever you can put on it. Just the fact that it goes back to what you said earlier, developing for it is much easier.
You could get yourself a video iPod.
You know, I've considered that. I do a lot of traveling for work, and I did some comparisons, but some of the other, like the Arcos, I think makes a device that's similar that had a lot more functionality, and I think a lower price, a larger screen, better. It just seemed to be better all the way around. I did do some research on those, and that was probably 6 months ago, so I probably am not up to date on that stuff.
Yeah.
But they'd be great, like, to take on the plane with me. I could sit there and watch a movie. You know, I take my laptop, of course, and I'll watch a DVD or something like that, but it's not the same. Not the same. Anyway,
no,
so,
not at all.
Yeah, let's close up the mailbag here and move into a little bit of show and tell. And actually, since we're on the topic of movies or TV, I have been, now, the listeners who have listened to the show for back when I did it for a couple of years ago know that back then I didn't have cable television. I haven't had cable television for a long time. I would just flip through the channels, occasionally watch some regular prime time. People know my obsession with American Idol, which was on Fox. Shows like that. Well, now that I'm up here, I moved recently, and that's one of the reasons I unplugged for a while, moved, and I've got cable television again, which is very cool. Unfortunately, way too addictive, I think, because I'm watching more TV than ever, but thanks to the DVR, I can just set them up to record and watch them on the weekends or whatever. But one of the shows that I've been watching a lot recently is Lost. Best show on TV, I think. It's kind of a cock tease of a show. They leave you hanging every week wondering what's going to happen next. They're really bad about having lots of dangling plot lines. They're like X-Men comic books. They just leave so much stuff hanging out there and make you wonder what the hell it was all about. But on this last episode of Lost, they did something that I thought was really cool. Now, you don't watch Lost, right? You're not a big TV guy.
Yeah, I mean, I watch a couple of shows. I like Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Yeah,
I don't watch Lost.
Yeah, I don't see Aqua Teen Hunger Force doing something like this. This was kind of a cool thing that, all right, like, the long and short of it, Lost is basically this ongoing drama of these people trapped on this mysterious island. That's the 10,000 foot overhead view. So they're trapped on this island, and there's all these weird things that are happening, and nobody seems to know why. There's no logical reason, et cetera, et cetera. Well, as the story develops, they kind of come across this, I don't want to ruin too much of it either, but there's some kind of experiment going on. They're finding things along the island that is telling them that they have to do this, they have to push these buttons, they have to go here. Something's steering them and leading them, and basically it looks like it's some sort of social experiment that's being played on them, but they don't know by who, why, whether it's still going on or it's old. Well, they did something cool in this last episode, and I don't know how many people caught it, but during the commercials, towards the end of the show, they played a fake commercial. And they didn't do it coming out of the show, going into the commercials, or coming back from it. They've sandwiched it in between two real commercials, like a Burger King on one end and like a Ford on the other end, in the middle of the commercials, and it looked really real. And the only reason you'd really even notice it is if you recognize the name of the company they were advertising, you realize was the name of the company that was mentioned in the show. So I just think this is a really cool thing, and I'm going to throw this out there for some of the freaks. I know they like phone numbers sometimes. Basically, the commercial advertised a website and advertised at the bottom a phone number for more information. And the phone number was 1-877, it's an 8, it's a 1-877-HANSORG, which is the name of the company. That's 877-426-7674. So I thought that's really cool, and I actually called the number once just to see what it is, and I'm not going to do it on the show. I'm going to let people do that on their own if they're interested in it or if they haven't already. But it's just got some neat stuff. That's the kind of thing maybe we'd call on Freak Factor if we ever get that going again, but I think it's kind of neat that we're moving more towards interactive television, and this is something that I've been wanting for a long time. I think this one, unfortunately, it's not going to be really interactive. It's more like just throwing people some more stuff to play with and look at, and there's some discussion that it's related to Sprite commercially somehow, which if that turns out to be the case, that'll really suck. But I think it's a cool idea that I wish other shows and other places would do, and that's interacting more with your audience and getting them involved. And I don't mean calling to vote for your favorite idol after the show is over with. I mean actually having some kind of interactivity where they reveal clues through the phone number or through the website that leads you to other things that actually help enhance the storyline of the show. So anyway, I just wanted to get that number out in the air in case anybody wasn't aware of it. I thought that was kind of a cool thing. And other than that, something I've been going for... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I figure I'd drop in an anecdote. about that. I mean, and I don't have an exhaustive knowledge of this. There's probably a Wikipedia article on it, but there is the odd movie or television show that drops a real phone number for one reason or another. And one I remember is Sneakers. And I didn't catch this when it came out in the theater, but the scene where they get busted by the Secret Service, and they're asking River Phoenix what he wants or whatever, and he says he wants the Secret Service agent girl's phone number, and she gives him her phone number. The phone number she reads out is a real phone number, and like I said, I didn't catch it when I saw it in the theater, and it was a long time before I actually rented it. But when I rented it, I was like, wait a minute, that was a real number. So so I called it, and it was this voicemail box for some lady who was obviously irate about getting all these phone calls from these weird computer geeks. And she goes on about how she doesn't take dates, and this was some weird thing that MGM Universal Studios did, and it's not her number, and blah 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 blah. It was kind of funny.
Usually...
I have no idea what you get if you called that number today. And I really don't know what was on it originally, but I thought it was an interesting bit of trivia.
Yeah, and that's why usually in movies and TV shows they reserve 555. 555 is not a usable number. Anytime you hear something on a TV show, they may have a legitimate area code. Like you'll hear, I don't know, Law and Order, which is in New York, you'll hear them say 212-555 and then a number. But 555 is not a valid exchange, so it's never, those are never real numbers. And I thought that was just generally accepted. I guess they slipped up on that one, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that poor woman must have been... Whew.
Now, yeah. This is a sort of a nostalgic conversation. Sometimes some of the numbers in 555 are real numbers. Obviously, 555-1212 is always a real number.
Right.
But sometimes there's other stuff in there as well, and it's usually kind of in neat. There's a lot of dead air in between two random things that might exist in that space.
It'd be an interesting scan to see what people would find in some of those 555 exchanges. I mean, yeah, you're right. 1212 is an obvious one. So yeah, then maybe there is other interesting stuff after all. It's pretty much generally, I don't know if it's common knowledge, but it's pretty much accepted that if you're going to do a show, you just make up 555 whatever, and it's assumed to be not in use, but you never know.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to connect you with the consumer. You're going to get connected to some weird phone company system if the number exists. Maybe they put a loop test or something else, a toner in there. Sometimes there's weird stuff in there.
Be very careful.
That's my recollection from like a long, long time ago.
Yeah, be very careful with those numbers. I'll just leave that alone.
Yes, absolutely.
And actually this is another kind of funny thing, another TV thing that's hooked me. Purely, the show is utter garbage. It's called Deal or No Deal. And I've been watching this, well, I don't watch it regularly, it is garbage, but if I ever am catching it on, I have to admit that for some reason it intrigues me, it addicts me from the mathematical standpoint. I grab a notepad and pen, and I write down the combinations. And what this is, for those who don't know, it's basically a game show where they have a bunch of different dollar amounts from, I think, one penny, and then it jumps to like $1, $5, $10, and it jumps in these big increments up to $1 million. And there are, I think, 32 different numbers. There's 32 suitcases you pick, and each one has a dollar amount in it, supposedly randomly distributed each game. It resets since random. And to me, it's just a very intriguing algorithm behind it, because your goal is to end up with the $1,000 suitcase somehow. But it's a process of elimination. Fundamentally, all you're going to do is keep picking cases, and you're hoping you're eliminating small number amounts. And if you eliminate all the small numbers and you're left with a $1 million case, that's your ultimate goal, right? But it's just so, I don't know, brilliant to me that I don't know if irony is the right word, but the more of the small amount cases you get rid of, you're left with large cases with large amounts in it, and statistically, your odds of picking a low number go down. So you're inevitably going to end up picking the large numbers, and you're always going to end up in some average dollar amount over the long term. And any individual game, and I've written some articles on statistics and the lottery and stuff for 2600, and statistics people know that I'm very into that. I find all that stuff interesting. This is very cool. There's probably, if you balance out all the people who have won it, you'd probably come up with a pretty close average. And over the long term, history of the game, you'd probably find everybody would deviate towards that median and middle point. I've had conversations with friends about, you know, should there be a goal that if you get over the average amount, should you automatically call it quits? Should you automatically say, oh, well, the deal that I've been offered is X number of dollars, so I should quit and take that and run? So anyway, it's an intriguing algorithm. If you haven't looked into that, there's actually a really good Wikipedia article on that, since you mentioned Wikipedia. It's a really good article on that that links to some of the algorithms and stuff like that. And I've actually done a lot of work on it myself, trying to think about how it works. And I've kind of got the algorithm, I won't say cracked, but I've got it down to pretty close, so I know exactly how it's working. There's some kind of weighting system going on, and I just haven't ironed out exactly what the weight is like. So it's one of those things where I'm totally reverse engineering it by writing down the amounts, writing down the offer that comes in, and every time that happens, if I can ever find an algorithm that works, it should work universally on all of them. So I don't know why I find that interesting, but I do, and it's a complete waste of time that will never, ever get me anything in the world. But for some reason, I find that stuff interesting. So that's enough for my hacking stories for the week, I guess. It's been a while since you've been on the show there, buddy. What have you been up to?
I don't know, man. Working on projects and just chilling.
Yeah, you and I are in the same boat as far as we have a few projects that we can't talk about.
Yep, I got a lot of stuff. I don't know. Hopefully, I'll get opportunities to talk about some of the stuff I've been working on over the next few months. But it's all in the garage under the under sheets right now. So,
gotcha. Well, and now we did find time. We met up in Atlanta at Interzone, and I think that you mentioned earlier that you're trying to make it to Hope.
Gonna try. Definitely like Manhattan.
Yeah. So I've already booked for that, so I'll definitely be there. So we're definitely going to have to go hang out downtown Manhattan that
Excellent.
Weekend. Go get a drink at night some night. So,
yep.
All right, well,
There's some rumblings of throwing an industrial memetics party, but I don't know whether or not that's going to come together. There's some things in the works, though, perhaps.
Well, cool. Definitely let us know so we can tell the listeners about it. I'm sure there's lots of people listening that are going to be there. So, keep us in the loop on that. I guess now we should go into the main topic. We're 40 minutes in here, a little over 40. So we're going to need a little time to go through this. I'm going to go briefly over some of the general / easy stuff and then leave you with the hard stuff.
All right. Well, hopefully my explanations will be clear. This is one of those things where if this was a television and I could draw, it would be much easier to explain.
Exactly. We could do a Hack TV episode on this. It might be better. But what we're going to go, and see, this comes back to what you said earlier, too, is I can do so much reading on my own, and I have the tools, and I've played around with them, and I got a good, I can use them and know how they work, obviously. I can do the script kiddie, use the tools, big deal, big whoop there. But I did read the actual white paper, I guess, on this original concept and tried to kind of take it from there. And I got the very, very general basis of it, but the mathematics behind it is very, not obscure. I'm not sure what a good word is, actually, but we'll come to that in a minute. And basically, we're talking about, of course, rainbow tables, if I didn't already say that again. And rainbow tables were created by, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, the concept is from Dr. Felipe, or Dr. Philip, F-P-H-I-L-I-P-P-E. I guess that's Felipe, right? I guess. I don't know. Philip, Felipe, I'm sorry if I'm mangling your name. And the last one is Oechslin, O-E-C-H-S-L-I-N, Felipe Oechslin. And from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And that actually was based on an original idea from even further back, a cryptographer that you're very familiar with, Martin Hellman, of course, of Diffie-Hellman fame.
Yep. And also, yeah, the original idea was invented in 1980 by my Hellman and some other folks whose names I don't remember right now. And Hellman is Diffie-Hellman.
Yeah.
And then it was improved upon by Ron Ravast, who is a professor at MIT, and he's the R in RSA. And then this Felipe guy extended Ravast's ideas. It's really his concept that we call a rainbow table.
And it's really cool.
But it's a sort of subset of this generalized concept of a sort of efficient way to pre-compute hashes or ciphers, texts for cryptanalysis.
And it really is kind of cool and kind of, I mean, a lot of people think, you know, the internet age, we're inventing new things every day and technology is breaking so quickly. I find it interesting that we're the fundamental basis of this. Everybody thinks this rainbow tables is some new thing, that it's based on actually something from 1980, did you say, that was worked on
yep.
in the late 70s to get to that 1980 release?
Yep.
That, I think, is incredible, and that's why, you know, I always mention and find interesting mathematics, and I write articles and stuff on statistics and math, is because fundamentally, math is the basis for so many things that we find interesting today. It's very unappreciated by computer programmers, or computer geeks or hackers or whatever, if you ask me. I think mathematics is just the key to finding all of this new stuff, especially when it comes to cryptography.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you are a computer person, when I was in high school, you know, I was very into computers, but I wasn't like the most stellar math student. You know, my teachers used to say, you know, well, you're never going to accomplish anything in computers if you're not good at math. And I said, well, you know, I felt like computers were really a lot about being creative. But the fact is that I had a way of thinking about computer problems that was very logical. And when I went to college, I did a huge amount of math and, you know, basically learned to love it, basically by drinking it from a fire hose. But the thing is you know, I found that, you know, my sort of natural way of thinking about computer problems was, in a way related to the appropriate way of how to think about math. But math wasn't presented to me in the right way, I guess, in school. You know, they didn't really make it interesting. And, you know, there's this language that you use in mathematics to express mathematical concepts. And, you know, I never sort of learned the language or learned to express my sort of logical ideas in the language of math. And so, you know, once I learned the language by force, I found it fit a lot of the thinking that I was doing really well, but it was just it was not something that I was motivated to study until. I think that for computer people, cryptography is a really great way to get into math because we
Absolutely.
You know, because we think cryptography is interesting. You know, all these computer security protocols are sort of rooted in it, and it's neat and it's kind of you know spy versus spy stuff. So
right.
You know, it's kind of sexy, you know. And so people, you know, may spend time, you know, reading it because they find it interesting and find themselves staring at these complex equations and say, how do I decipher that? What does that mean? And find themselves, or find this becomes a gateway for them to really, you know, studying, you know, more basic math concepts and building up that sort of vocabulary of that language that they use to express equations in. So.
Right, and you know, a lot, even the people that I know a lot of people that claim to be into cryptography know, and all that, you know, they know that, you know, they make statements like, oh, RSA is better than SHA, is better than this, or this is used for that, but they don't understand that the mathematics upon which they are based, which is something that, I don't know, me, I just want to know that kind of stuff. I find it interesting. Maybe that's a personality quirk. But again,
I think that this, that's, like I was saying in the beginning, that's what this scene is about. And, you know, cryptography is a field that you can plunge into that can consume your whole life. There's no limit to how deep you can go with this stuff, how challenging it can become, if you're really interested in it. If you get bored with cryptography, you're not looking at it in the right way, I think.
Yeah. Well, and let's move into the application of cryptography tonight that we're talking about, which is Rainbow Tables once again. And Rainbow Tables, a lot of people, and see, I actually posed this question in IRC, and you get some pretty responses like, well, this is all it is. It's that simple. Like, what's to talk about? You know, there's not a lot of detail. Well, actually, there is, because when you talk about how and why they work, that's where the detail is, and the interesting part is, to me. So, kind of a disclaimer, a warning, some of this might get kind of dry, like Desi is referring to on the radio. It's kind of hard to illustrate on the radio. We're going to give it our best shot and see if we can't explain it. Let's talk about kind of an overview of what it is, first of all. Let me put a couple facts out there to keep in mind as we go along. First of all, this is something that only works for hashing algorithms. It's something that is only going to work for an algorithm that's going to produce a fixed value, a fixed hash every time. A hash, of course, being a ciphertext representation of, like, a password, for example. When you create a password, it's going to run it through this algorithm, and it's going to generate a hashed version of it, an obfuscated version of it, however you want to refer to it. And some examples of things like that are like MD5, which is Message Digest. That's one of the most common ones. SHA, LM, which is Windows LAN Manager, or NT passwords. That's really, I think, the one thing that you see most commonly used by Rainbow Tables. Most people will use it for NT, Windows NT password. But one of the ones that I find interesting was MySQL actually uses a system that can be, this can be used on. So, and there are others besides that.
The important thing to understand about a hash function is that it's a one-way function. You take information, it goes through this this mathematical manipulation, and you get junk out the other side. And it's very difficult to, if you have the junk, to come up to figure out what the thing that went in was to begin with. And so it gives you the security property. And once you send it through the junk and out the other side, it's very difficult for people to get back. One game that a friend of mine and I played at a conference once was to take an MD5 hash of our name and write it on our badge. Mm-hmm. And so if you didn't know who we were, that MD5 hash wasn't going to help you figure us out, you know, because you can't get back from that hash to a nickname. But if you thought you knew who we were, you could take the name that you thought was our nickname and take the MD5 hash of it and see if it was the same as what we'd written on our name tag. And so we thought that was kind of interesting.
And did anybody get it?
No, but you know, whatever. We got drunk and you know mostly forgot about it, but it was kind of a neat idea.
Yep, that's pretty much how the conference ends. All right, so Rainbow Table. So those are some facts to think about up front. The one way is good, excellent point. And what the Rainbow Table does basically is this is when you traditionally think of cracking a password, the first thing of course is brute force. And that is an application of some kind that's going to simply throw combinations at a hashed password or any kind of password for that matter and try to just brute force it, usually by having a dictionary file handy where you're pulling in common words. It's one of the reasons people always say good password policies use special characters, use mixed case, use spaces, numbers, letters, mixed case, et cetera, because if you're using something that's a common word from a dictionary, then dictionary attacks can be very successful against those type words, obviously. Well, when you have stronger passwords, and keep that dictionary in mind, we're going to come back to that in a second, because Decius actually made a really good point to me before we started recording. But with the Rainbow Tables, when you've got a more complex password, you've got so many possibilities to go through, especially if you're just, let's call it a random, let's say it's really a bunch, it's not even close to a, it's not like password 571. It's actually P5J underscore. If it's really just weird stuff, Rainbow Tables can be more effective on that type of password. And the, what it is basically is doing all of the work up front. Instead of getting on a system and trying to do a brute force attack right then and there on the fly, you're doing all of the work up front to generate what's called a rainbow table. And we're going to talk a little bit about what that is. But think very large tables of predetermined hashes. And that is overly simplifying it, but for now, keep that in mind. You've got a bunch of predetermined hashes, and obviously, it's going to be huge, huge files. I mean, when you're talking about how many possible combinations of passwords they are, you're talking gigantic files, gigabytes and gigabytes of data. However, depending on exactly how you make them and the variables involved, which I'm going to talk about next, you can create a very high percentage chance that almost every combination of password can be cracked depending on how big you make your tables and how exhaustive you set the variables to be. Now, the other factor in this is, yes, you're doing all the work up front, but it's still a lot of freaking work. You need a lot of power to generate these tables. You're still doing work. It's just you're doing it up front to put them in big files so that when it comes time to actually crack passwords, you're using the memory of the computer to parse through all these huge tables to find what you're looking for. So I mentioned earlier this works on hashed passwords, but it will not work for any hash that's been salted. And do you want to kind of explain what salting is?
Sure. Well, so on a Unix machine, see, a lot of times hashes are used as follows. You take someone's password and you hash it and you store it in the password file. So that way you don't have to store their actual password in the password file. And so if somebody sees the password file, they don't get everyone's password. And then when they log in, the login process takes their password and hashes it and compares it against the hash that's in the password file. And if they're the same, you know, it lets you in. And so Unix machines, you know, have been doing this since the 70s or there, and they have a salted hash, which means that there's a couple of numbers that are appended to your password before it goes through the one-way hash function, and that makes things a little complex. Basically the password love, for instance, if the MD5 hash of the password love is always the same. But if you add the salt of a couple of characters, then you have, maybe it's two characters, then you've got, 16 bits of entropy that you've added in addition to whatever the password is, just a huge number of different ways that the hash result could turn out. And so rainbow tables tend to break down when you're talking about that much added complexity. So usually when people are cracking salted hashes, they do their calculations on the fly using the salt that appears in the password file. They generate a hash of their dictionary and compare the results of that with what appeared in the password file and check to see if they're the same. Microsoft, when they it's really not their fault, actually. The LAN manager hash is older than that, from the 80s or wherever this NetBIOS stack came from. But that hash is not salted, and so it's a lot weaker than a Unix password hash. There, for each given password that someone might have, there's only one possible result, and so it's possible to, I mean, it's when you the real advantage of rainbow tables is this. Because there's no salt, you could take the entire list of possible passwords and you could hash them all. And you could have this database with every possible hash result. It would take you a while to generate it, but you could do it. And the problem is that you have this huge file that would just take up massive, massive amounts of space and would take you a very long time to search. And it, you know, and of course, generating it also would take, you know, extremely long period of time, you know, on the order of years. So, you know, what you want to do is cut the time down a little bit. And the way you do that, the way that Rainbow Tables help you do that is by reducing the amount of data that you have to search. Instead of having to store every single possible hash of every single possible password, you only have to store a small percentage of them in memory. And based on those results, you can easily find the most of the hashes, regardless of the fact that you haven't stored as much data. It's sort of like a trade-off between the amount of memory that you have and the amount of processing power that you have. Rainbow Tables give you a really good sort of balance between the two that lets you have a relatively small amount of data, but get your results relatively quickly with, you know, a low amount of computation.
And you referred, of course, to the huge tables. There are a couple variables that determine that and make your table size or define it. Now, even on the smallest scale, they're going to be big tables. We're talking, I would say, probably 1/660 meg to fit on a CD table might cover a basic character set. And the character set is one of the variables on creating these rainbow tables. What characters do you know are going to be in the password? Certain algorithms may or may not allow certain types of letters. Is it going to have, and not only algorithms, but more to the point, password policies at the company? Are all the passwords converted to uppercase, Windows style, for example? Are the passwords going to allow mixed case? Are they going to allow numerics? Are they require numerics at the company, what their password policy is? Does it require special characters? Well, you develop your rainbow tables using, well, I'm going to simplify it to two important things. One, the algorithm that you're going to use. What type of hash is it? And let's say it's an MD5, for an argument's sake. An MD5, and then what character set are you going to use? Are you going to use simply 26 characters for the 26 letters of the alphabet? You know that there's no chance of numbers ever showing up. Let's say you're building one for your company to do password audits, which is a valid application for this. You're a security officer, you want to make sure that your employees are using good passwords or whatever, which if you're using a basic character set, you're not, but I won't go there. You want to do an audit to make sure everybody's changing their password or something every so often. You can create a rainbow table based on just the character set of the 26 alphabetic characters. And it's going to make a pretty big file, but not nearly as big as if you also know that you require them to put a number in their password. If they have love as their password, and you know it's an easy word to figure out, and it's all alphabetic characters, then you make a smaller table. There's no point in checking for numbers if you know it doesn't exist. However, if their password requires a number and it's love14, then you add the numeric characters. Or if it requires special characters, or there's a potential of special characters, you want to add those to the character set that you use to build your table. So love_14! Becomes a more complex password, and you have to build larger and larger tables to account for this. And your success probability falls into play here. The smaller you make the tables, the lower percent chance, the lower space that you're making available to use these passwords. It's going to try to do it as smartly as it can, but you're going to, basically it's the law of diminishing returns, another statistical term, mathematical term. Your law of diminishing returns is the smaller this table is, you're going to get a base percentage chance of success. Let's say you start with 50% chance of success when it's a 5 gigs file, I don't know. As you move towards 60%, it's not going to take another 10 gigs, it may take 12 gigs. And then for you to get a 70% success rate, it's going to take even more. So the closer you get towards that 100% success rate, the larger your files are going to be. So, if you go for absolute perfection, a character set that includes every special character, including a space, people forget about the space, special characters, spaces, numbers, alpha, huge character set, a complex algorithm, and you want 100% success probability. First of all, I don't know that you can actually get 100%. I'm not sure. Do you know if it's possible?
I think it is. But it would be... you run into a little bit of trouble at the edges with basically chains merging. You can run into some limitations in terms of the space you can search, but in general, you can get very close to that.
Yeah, so there comes a point where you're saying, you know what, if I can crack 97%, which is a number I see quite frequently, or even 70, 80%, whatever you're comfortable with, you generate that table, and that's about the success rate you're going to have in cracking it. Now, again, if you go with simpler character sets and lower file size, you can still get a higher success rate for that lower file size. And when you increase both of those variables, create more tables, you're getting a higher percentage chance. And the other thing that's important to note is that these tables are portable. This is the other really cool thing. There's no point in anybody ever recreating another rainbow table. If someone's has created it, it's going to work universally. We said earlier in the beginning that hash that's generated with that algorithm is going to be universal. If I create the password love on my machine and Decius creates it on his machine using that same algorithm with, say, Windows NT password, it's going to create the same hash. Therefore, the same tables are going to work on both of our machines. So if you've ever been to maybe hacking conferences or seen websites where you can buy or download rainbow tables, that's absolutely fine. Understand the character set that they've given you. You know, don't download or buy or whatever a CD that only has alphanumeric and you know your passwords have special characters. You know, but then there's that trade-off, the size that comes in. Do you want to buy everything on one DVD, or are you going to buy 20 DVDs? How thorough do you want to get? So the portability is an important thing, and again, the huge file size, I can't emphasize that enough. You could probably take 20 gigs if you wanted to go, I would say if you wanted to get 90% success rate on a really full character set, it would take at least 20 gigs of data to get you even, I don't know, 70% or higher, maybe as high as 90%. I don't even think you'd get that much out of 20 gigs. So to put it in perspective,
Frank, in the paper, it depends totally on the hash. In the paper, they were using the NT LAN Manager hash, and they were able to crack 99% with 1.5 megabits of data, or sorry, gigabits, 1.5 gigs of data. They weren't running, sort of one of the tools that's available. They wrote their own code, to sort of prove their concept. But they 1.5 gigs is a pretty manageable amount of space these days. But if you're talking about a different kind of hash, that has larger, like a SHA, 512 hash, I guess it produces longer output.
Right.
You know, that's obviously going to take more space to store, and so you're going to end up with bigger files.
Yeah, that's a good point. The length of the hash that's generated is absolutely another variable that I didn't even think about. You're absolutely right. That's a good point.
And as well as that, as well as the length of the passwords in question. I mean, if you NT LAN Manager has a hard limit in terms of the length of passwords, but if you've got some hashing algorithm and you're looking at longer and longer potential passwords, then that's going to require more hashes be done, and so that's going to hit your table there.
All right, well, I'll tell you what, let's go into a little bit. Now, again, this is kind of tough to do over the radio, but we'll wait till the plane overhead passes, but we're about at, let's see, we've got about 10 or 15 more minutes left, and I would like to discuss the math part of this. Now, understand that this is going to be kind of difficult to illustrate, so we're going to do our best to see if we can make this make sense, but this is pretty complex math. Again, if you go back to the original paper, if you really want to do some independent study, do a search for Dr. Felipe. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Oshlin.
If you just search for rainbow tables, first link you're going to get off of Google will have a link to this paper.
Yeah, you can find it pretty easily. Go ahead.
But the I guess the two important things to keep in mind when I start are that the whole point of this is to reduce, instead of storing a hash of every single possible password, I want to store less data than that and have to search less data than that. Even if you tweak the settings out, with your rainbow table generator so that, you're generating huge tables that take up a lot of space, the space that your tables take up is a fraction of the space that they would take up if you were just sort of storing all of the hashes in the password space that you're searching. And so that's really the power of this technique. And the second thing to keep in mind, as we said, is that a hash is a one-way function. Data goes in, and it comes back out junk. And that junk is always going to be the same. If the input was the same, the output's going to be the same. And so the way it works is as follows. You generate these things called chains. They're hash chains. And you start with a potential password, for example, and you hash it, and you get the result. Then you take that result and you hash it again, and so you get the third result, and you hash that again and get the fourth result, and you hash that again and get the fifth result. And so, in theory, each one of these, you have all these functions chained up in a row, and for each one, you have an input and an output. The input is a potential key that you could be looking for, a potential password, and the output is the hash that would be stored for that password. And so you build these chains, and you store in these chains can be 10,000 hashes long, for example, and you build tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of these chains. But what you store to disk are just the first and last entry in each chain. So that's where you get your sort of reduction in the space. You have this table that has, for each one of these functions in the chain is a password and its associated hash. But all you have to do is store the first and last one in each chain, and so the other, say, 9,999 that you threw out, or 98 that you threw out, you don't have to keep them on disk, and you don't have to search them. And so that's really where you're getting your performance enhancement from. So let's say you're trying to crack a password hash that you pulled off of a machine. You've got this hash, and what you do is you make a chain starting with it. You hash it, and then you take the result and you hash that, and you take the result and you hash that. And so in our example, we did this 10,000 times. So you're going to do it 10,000 times. And then for each of those 10,000 answers, you're going to search your tables that you stored and see if that password appears for any of the chains that you have as the last entry in the chain. And so if you think about it, when you get a match, what that means is, I'll frame things a little bit more simply, so that it's easy to think about. Let's say each one of the chains I originally generated had five they iterated the function five times. So you've got number one and number five stored in your database.
Let's say
somewhere within that huge list of chains, there's a chain that when I generated originally had the actual password that I'm trying to crack in it, and it was the third one in the chain. If you take that password and you hash it, you're going to get a result, which is going to generate a result when it's hashed. And so the last one in that chain is going to show up in my list if I take the password I pulled off the machine, or the hash that I pulled off the machine, and I start hashing it over and over again. because it's an iterative function and it always reaches the same result. And so once I found a match in the table for the matches one of the results of my iteratively hashing the thing I'm trying to crack, I can take the first, because I start the first and last entry in each chain, I can take the first entry in that chain and start iteratively hashing it until I get to the thing that I was looking for. And of course the value that produced it is the password. That may be difficult to follow, but that's really the simplest possible way to explain it.
I think that was very good. Actually, I think keeping it down with a small number of five, I think, is a very good way to kind of demonstrate this. That you find that last one and you can back, you know, that you've narrowed it down, that there's an overlap there.
It could really help if you try to do it on paper, if you try to write this down. You take a number, you hash it, you take it, that result, and hash it, and make a chain of five, and then you pretend that you pulled the third one in that chain off of a computer, and you make five hashes of it. You'll see that the fifth one in your first list is the the third one in your second list,
exactly.
And so you have a match. And you
excellent.
Can see that based on the first one in the list, the first list you generated, you could get back to the third one.
Excellent.
So if you just kind of lay it out on paper and try it, hopefully it'll make sense.
I think that's excellent. I think that was a great job in explaining, and I think that is understandable. And also, just to kind of reiterate something you said too, is that you know that these iterations are going to both work out the same, that they're going to come up to the same conclusion, because you're reiterating. I don't know if that's the proper way to say it. You're coming up with the iterative hash of the hash before it and the one before it, which goes back to that original password. And as we said at the beginning of this conversation, because of the way a hashing algorithm works, it's going to create the same hash. So you're all starting from the same place. So
the there's something that's I think important to explain. There's two things that I need to explain, and I'm gonna sort of go backwards here, because I think that one of the things I want to explain helps people you understand this a little bit better. When you the thing that I have kind of a criticism of the use of rainbow tables.
I know where this
is going.
And
that is that most people have lame passwords. They have passwords that are based on dictionary words. And so if you've got this, if you think about this hash train, when you take a password like love and you MD5 hash it, you're going to get a bunch of gobbledygook. And then if you hash that, you're going to get more gobbledygook. And so if you look at one of these hash chains, even if you started with something which could reasonably be a password, most of the entries in the chain are going to be gobbledygook that is highly unlikely to be someone's real password. If you do this, if you have 32,000 chains with 10,000 entries, like, eventually, some of those things are actually going to be dictionary words, but it's just sort of at random that
right,
happens.
Right, it's kind of random, exactly.
And so, if you were to take a dictionary which had, maybe 300,000 dictionary words in it, and permutations of those words, and you were to hash all of them, chances are good that you would end up with a search space that's smaller than most than your typical rainbow table. And the thing is that, and I mean, you're going to find, 80% of the passwords you'd expect to find in the real world that way. And so, where you get a real advantage out of rainbow tables is when you're really trying to crack, sophisticated passwords that might be the kind of gobbledygook you're going to get out of reiterating this hash function. you know, I think that sheds a little bit of light onto to how this thing actually works. But it also goes to say, like, I think there's a lot of people who are employing these tools who, you know, who you know, could get away with doing something much less complex, you know, and get you know, a similar kind of result out of it in terms of the you know, the effectiveness that it has in, you know, finding bad passwords. I guess the other thing that I should explain is that the sort of algorithm that I just described to you is a very simplified explanation, and it's really an explanation of the kinds of things that that Hellman was talking about. And Hellman didn't coin the term rainbow table to refer to his innovation. And, you know, and then Rivest built upon what Hellman did, and Felipe built upon what Rivest did, and Felipe, his algorithm is what is really referred to as rainbow tables, but I haven't dug into this deep enough to really get to the difference between what Felipe is doing and what Hellman is doing. But basically, there, when you're iterating through these hash functions, you don't just take the result of the hash and hash it again. In reality, you also send it through this thing called a reduction function. And the reduction function, in Hellman and Rivest's versions was always the same, and this created a real serious problem with chains merging, where basically, you know, you start generating a chain, and eventually it sort of syncs up with another chain that you generated previously. And so in order to combat that, what Felipe did was change the reduction function every single time he iterated, which reduced the probability of having chains merge. And so he gets a lot of performance advantages out of that. But you know, and so you have to have, in order to really have a rainbow table, quote unquote, you have to have a reduction function that changes at each iteration. But, you know, getting into the details of what a reduction function is and how it plays in is, you know, sort of information overload for this, for this radio show.
I think we might blow some minds with that one.
The other thing that I want to point out is that when Hellman was thinking about this stuff originally, he wasn't trying to crack passwords. And in fact, like, I think Hellman would have strongly advised the folks that were designing some of these authentication systems to use salted hashes so that they were still, you know, well outside the reach of a rainbow table that you could generate on a you might imagine generating on a PC. You know, what he was trying to do is he was trying to crack encrypted files. And you can use rainbow tables to do that. And the scenario, you know, a lot of files have the exact same header. You know, maybe information within the file is different. The first, you know, maybe n bytes of the file are going to be the same regardless of what's in it. You know, a lot of times this happens just kind of through force of habit. Like, how many C++ source files have you seen that start with a slash and then a bunch of asterisks?
Right.
You know, a lot. So if you took that sort of header and you assume that's going to be the front of a lot of files that might be encrypted that I want to decrypt, then what I can do is, instead of doing a hash in my, when I'm generating my rainbow table, I take that text and I desencrypt it with a key. And then I take the output of that DES encryption and use it as the key for the next DES encryption. And I do that iteratively instead of hashing the hash. And, you know, what I end up doing is getting a rainbow table for a file with a particular header encrypted with every possible DES key. And so if I have an encrypted file that starts with that header, I can check my rainbow table you know, for that header and hopefully find the key, and then I can decrypt the file. And so, you know, if you were to generate, you know, you know, a huge collection of these DAS rainbow tables, then you could you know, with a large number of sort of common headers, and you were trying to crack open a file, and you could guess the first few characters of that file, you might be able to decrypt the whole thing this way. I think that's a pretty interesting aspect to this too, that you don't see a lot of people talking about necessarily.
Right. Well, I tell you what, we're running kind of low here, so the one other thing I want to do, and if there's anything else you wanted to talk about, I wanted to at least throw some of the tools out there so that if people do want to follow up and play around with this on their own and kind of see if they can understand it better just from playing with the tools that are out there. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we move on to that?
No, I'm done.
Yeah, I think it's a I really like the and I agree completely with the point of the dictionary attack. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about the plain character sets. If you're just using alphabetic characters, you know it's probably dictionary words most likely, then yeah, it's probably not going to pay off for you to build a rainbow table for something like that. However, I think more people are still going to use it because of the universality of it. I don't know if that's a word, universality, that if you make, you know, get that 97, 99% or whatever for 1.5 gigs, a lot of people might just go with it for ease of use. It may, it's not going to be the most efficient. There are better ways, but it will still probably work. So I don't see that. I see people still using it that way. Some of the tools, of course, you know, one of the obvious one is Rainbow Crack. But there's another one out there called OPH Crack, which is very good. There's a Windows tool called WinRTGen, which I think the original was called RTGen, which Rainbow Tables Generator. There's a WinRTGen that I like a lot. I think it's really cool, and it's a great tool to download and understand what we're talking about with the character sets and the algorithms. You can actually see that on the fly, and it will do some estimates and calculations. Change some of those variables and watch how your percentage of success drops as opposed to how many files you have to create to make better success rate, excuse me. In addition to that, because once again the universality of boy, I hope that's a word. I'm totally using it. The files are universal and are going to work no matter which computer they were generated on because the way hashing works. They can be done online. There are a lot of companies now, I don't know if companies, there are a lot of people that are charging that if you send them the hash, they'll run it through their rainbow tables, through their website or whatever, and charge you a price for it and do the work for you. So there are a lot of places I've seen popping up lately to do it online. What I would like to see, and I'll throw this out to the community, I would really think it would be cool if somebody out there who had a really big box were to make that kind of service publicly available. I think you'd get a lot of hits. I think a lot of people would be interested in that. If you were to take a big several hundred gig or multiple hard drives, store a bunch of very large rainbow tables, a lot of them have already been created. Like I said, you can find the ones that are already done, and there are people out there sharing them, and make them, put them on the website, not so much for download, because it'd kill your bandwidth downloading gigabytes of tables, but maybe a way that people could submit hashes and have the work done, have it queued up, and have it mailed back to them or something along those lines. I think that would make a very cool community project. But there are some people that are doing it now as pay sites. And a lot of the security tools, Kane and Abel, I know, has built in right-click for to submit a hash as well. So a lot of the security tools are going that route to give another option instead of just a brute force dictionary attack. They're offering this. And I even saw, I don't think it hasn't been started yet, but I saw a project has been created for a distributed tool for rainbow table generation. Because as we said, it also takes a lot of power and time to generate these up front. So that might be a neat distributed project. So that wraps it up for rainbow tables, at least as far as we're going to get into them on this show. And truthfully, if anybody does find them more interesting and wants to go further, this is the point where they really need to take the initiative and go out there and really read, because it does get so much more complex. I mean, I've had trouble wrapping my head around a lot of it, and that's why I thank you, Decius, for helping me understand it better as well as our listeners, because it is something that, you know, I like to understand not only what it's doing, but why and how it's doing it, and I do feel like I've gained that out of this episode. So hopefully the listeners have too. As we wrap it up, only reminder I have is that this Friday our BenRev meeting. So if you have a BenRev meeting nearby, or if you want to start one, contact us. But BenRev meeting's this Friday, and I'll kick it over to you for any shouts. If you want to say, give shouts out to anybody, I'll let you go with that.
Well, I'll shout out to Rattle and Acidus, who may be out there listening to the show. And I thank you for having me on again. I always like getting the opportunity to talk about this kind of stuff. So,
And we love having you. We love having you on the show. And I think this will be I'm pretty sure this will be a very popular show. I think a lot of people are going to learn from this because most people stop after they see how it works. Or what it does, I should say, and now they're going to know a lot more about how it works. So, totally Acidus. Virgil, I spoke to an email not too long ago, so it was good to talk to him again. And we're actually, I guess, under announcements. Maybe next week we'll announce more detail, but I've been working with Emmanuel to try to put together some events for Hope. So once we get some of that ironed out, we might have a few cool surprise events going on at Hope. So let's see, site of the week. I have a site out there. We have a little project site we created that seemed to be in demand. It's called hackerevents.org, all one word, hackerevents.org. And it's nothing but I threw up an open source calendar client on there. People can go submit events that are upcoming. There's so many local cons, smaller cons now, meetings, etc. that I thought it would be kind of useful to have one central calendar anybody can submit. So if you have a local Linux user group meeting, put it on there. I've already put on the 2600 meetings for the rest of the year, BenRev meetings, DEF CON meetings, et cetera, et cetera. I put on HOPE, DEF CON, all the conferences that were announced at the time when I was creating it, all on that calendar. So you kind of look ahead and see, make your plans around where you want to go, et cetera, et cetera. If you have any feedback on the show, radio@benrev.com. That's the only place that we're going to read emails on the air if you want them. Anything else you send it to, I get people send stuff to my personal account or something. I'll read them. I don't know that I'll always get back to you because I get a lot of email, but radio@benrev.com will always be read by one of us and possibly read on the air, so make sure you send it there only. Our closing music tonight is a track called Code Monkey, which is pretty much what my job is, one of my favorite words I use on the show. I am a code monkey. The song is called Code Monkey. It's by Jonathan Coulton, Calton, C-O-U-L-T-O-N, and the website is jonathancalton.com. So Google for it if you can't find it. And that's it. Decius, once again, thank you for being on the show. We're probably a couple minutes over, so I guess in between coughs here, we will tell everybody that we will see them next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.
We're both coughing and trying to get it out. Next week. Later.
Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey, very diligent, but his output stinks. His code not functional or elegant. What do Code Monkey think? Code Monkey think maybe manager wanna write goddamn login page himself. Code Monkey not say it out loud. Code Monkey not crazy, just proud. Code Monkey like Fritos. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey very simple man with big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey hang around at front desk till your sweater look nice. Code Monkey offer buy you soda, bring you cup, bring you ice. You say no thank you for the soda, cause soda make you fat. Anyway, you busy with the telephone, no time for chat. Code Monkey have long walk back to cubicle. He sit down to tend to work. Code Monkey not thinking so straight. Code Monkey not feeling so great. Code Monkey like Fritos. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey very simple man, big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Monkey thinks someday he have everything, even pretty girl like you. Code Monkey just waiting for now. Code Monkey says someday, somehow. Code Monkey likes Fritos. Code Monkey likes Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey, very simple man. Big, warm, fuzzy, secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Monkey like you.